When the 2013 fishing season opens in a week and a half, Gulf of Maine cod fishermen will be facing a nearly 80% cut in their catch allowances. That's what fishery scientists say is necessary to halt overfishing of fragile cod stocks. It's the latest blow to a fleet that has shrunk dramatically in recent years and is struggling to find a path forward. But it's far from a new problem. Cod fishermen have been plying New England's waters for centuries, and as long as there have been fishermen, there has been concern about the sustainability of fisheries. Dr. Jeffrey Bolster is Associate Professor of History and Co-Director of the Center for History of Marine Animal Populations at University of New Hampshire. He's written about topics ranging from African-American seamen in the age of sail to the role of shipping in the making of America. His most recent book is titled The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. It chronicles a millennium of overfishing and fishing regulations, first off Europe's coasts and then here in the New World. The Mortal Sea was one of this year's winners of Columbia University's prestigious Bancroft Prize. Professor Bolster, welcome to Living Lab.
Thanks, Heather. Nice to be here.
The history of marine animal populations, that is not a center title that you hear all the time. What do you see being the importance of a historical perspective in addressing ecological issues?
Oh, I think, Heather, that without historical understandings, we can have no idea of the magnitude of the restoration challenges we face. In other words, if one's timeline for restoration is only 6 years or 8 years or 10 years, and you look back a certain time with a very short data set, that becomes a very short-term political goal for restoration rather than an ecologically appropriate goal, perhaps, for restoration.
How do you actually go about estimating things like catch amounts and stock levels from hundreds of years ago when there was really no means of doing that at the time?
Our group here at the University of New Hampshire, a group that consists of historians, ecologists, and biostatisticians, actually pioneered some methodologies, which are a small part of my book, but our group published a paper some years ago about modeling cod biomass using historical data. In a nutshell, we found a run of very accurate fishing records from the 1850s and 60s, all compiled by American fishermen who were fishing on the Nova Scotian shelf. There were hundreds of logbooks with annotations as well in each logbook about other vessels that they had spoken and what their reported catches were. But each logbook gives for each day of a fishing season, an entire summer, where the vessel was, the depth of water it was in, how many men were fishing, how many codfish they were catching, and then the total weight of the entire trip, which gives you the average weight per fish. And so, you know, it's as if you had a satellite camera suspended over the Nova Scotian shelf in the 1850s. We could tell you where all these different boats were and what they were catching. So you take that data, which is very difficult to manage, but you take that data, and the data is clean for a variety of reasons. There was no incentive to fudge it. Men got paid by the number of fish they were catching individually. The boat got paid by the weight of the trip. The government bounty was paid by the tonnage of the vessel. So there's no fudging. And so it's good, clean data. But then you have to marry it with contemporary population modeling methods, the sort of ones that, sort of techniques that fishery scientists use today to try to estimate populations of fish. And their biologists use these for other organisms as well. So that was the that was really the signature accomplishment of our interdisciplinary group, was to use historical data and contemporary population modeling methods to create estimates of cod biomass in fished areas in the past, much farther back than there had been estimates previously available. So we understand more what the state of the fishery was like, let's say, around the American Civil War.
I mean, obviously, your book goes back much further than 1850s, and you say in the introduction to The Mortal Sea that you really felt it was important to recast the ocean as a player in history, as a character in history, rather than a setting for history to take place. What do you mean by that? How do you make the ocean a player?
Oh, the ocean has been very much a player. You know, mythologically, we sort of imagine the ocean was just this barrier to be crossed so that we could settle Plymouth or Boston or settle Quebec and then start the New World. The real story there is the rise of new nations in a new world. But if you go back to how people in the 16th and 17th century imagined it, for the most part, you know, for well over 100 years before there was any settlement in North America, permanent settlement, Europeans came every season to fish. They came to collect codfish and whales, to process them, to return, with no idea of starting new countries or, you know, free ideas about freedom of religion. They were simply out in the fringes of the Western Ocean to catch fish. So I think that if we look at the Atlantic Ocean as a complicated ecological system, as a treasure house, as the way it was imagined in different periods by different times, it becomes a player in the drama. Quite simply, the discovery of America hinged on the depletion of European seas. And the first people that came here were fishermen and whalers, and the reason they came across the North Atlantic in stormy February and March was simply because they had already exhausted the grounds close to home. With the technology available to them, they could no longer make the catches they wanted or needed of whales and cod and other species in European waters, and they sailed across the tempestuous North Atlantic. That should get our attention.
I mean, that really is, that's quite a feat, especially several hundred years ago. We now traverse the Atlantic by plane all the time and really think nothing of it. But to, as you said, make that trip across the ocean, especially in winter, in rough seas, in the North Atlantic, very cold, very rough seas, this was extremely treacherous. The fishermen must have been extremely driven. How great was the reward that they faced when they returned to Europe with fish from around Cape Cod and around New England?
Oh, you know, you could make good trips here. If you could get your ship across the Western Ocean, as they called it, they didn't really call it the Atlantic for a long time, but you get across the Western Ocean in February and March, and you set up your temporary fishing camp on the South Shore of Newfoundland or parts of Nova Scotia or later in the Gulf of Maine, like the Isles of Shoals or Monhegan, and you fish for the season, and then you go home again in the fall, hopefully before the hurricane season, you could catch so many fish here that you could make a good trip of it. Now, obviously, the hardships, you know, by our scale are off the chart, but the real point is that this was an ecosystem with which Europeans were very familiar. It was dramatically the same. In other words, when Europeans went to the Philippines or the Caribbean, they saw all these bizarre fish and weird organisms, and it was exotic. But when they came to Newfoundland or the Gulf of Maine, ho-hum, same old stuff. Oh, they got herring, they got salmon, they've got eider ducks, there's harbor seals, codfish, but there was more of everything. That's what got their attention.
Yeah, you in the book talk about all of these accounts of early explorers just talking about the incredible abundance of a variety of things. And one that really caught my attention was walruses, that there apparently used to be large walrus populations off the coast of North America.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the breeding walrus populations were as far south as Nova Scotia. We today imagine walrus as an Arctic species because the remnant walrus population today lives in the Arctic. But when Europeans first arrived, there were large walrus populations breeding in the Gulf of St. Lawrence, on the south shore of Newfoundland, and on islands off of Nova Scotia. So that is an example of range contraction, where an organism that was hunted seriously was not exterminated, but its distribution or its range was reduced considerably because of human hunting pressure.
I'm talking with Professor Jeffrey Bolster, author of The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. We invite you to join our conversation. 866-999-4626 is our number. Our email is livinglabradio@wgbh.org, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Now, you mentioned, Professor Bolster, the fact that it wasn't for some time that the Atlantic came to actually be called the Atlantic. For a long time, it was called the Western Ocean. And in The Mortal Sea, you make this interesting point that, of course, calling it the Atlantic implies suddenly the dawning of an understanding that there are multiple oceans and a completely different global geography than had been previously understood. When did that awareness really come about?
Oh, you know, there, European seamen were aware, certainly, of lots of oceans. We name oceans right now in a way that we think is normalized to the extent that we sort of assume it's always been this way. And when you talk about the Atlantic as a separation between the Old World and the New World, it reinforces that the real story there is the rise of new nations in the New World. People at the time, though, certainly in the 1500s and the early 1600s, throughout the 1600s, they didn't necessarily see it that way. So the Atlantic was not named as the Atlantic until that was used commonly by the 18th century, the 1700s. But prior to that, it was sort of seen as the Great Ocean Sea, the Western Ocean, and people just went to the extremity of it to fish. So the imaginations of, let's say, some English fishermen in the 1500s were that you could fish off Lancashire, that's the west coast of England, sort of in the Irish Sea, or you could sail across Newfoundland and fish, and it was all sort of the same thing. That's a really different perspective than modern Americans or Canadians who imagine that everyone was focused on getting across the Atlantic Ocean to the New World. So by changing the way the story has been told, in effect by me going back to the to honor the perspective of people at that time, how they saw what they were doing, what we see is that the boreal North Atlantic, North Atlantic between the Gulf Stream on the south border and the Arctic on the north border, that boreal North Atlantic ecosystem that stretches from Cape Cod to Newfoundland here and across the North Atlantic and then from the English Channel up to Norway, it was just all one piece of ocean that had all very similar organisms and similar range of temperature. But in Europe, it had been fished hard for 1,000 years, and that was not the case in America. And so when people came here, just the edge of the Western Ocean, they found a very familiar place that was just full of fish. In effect, they were seeing what the Eastern Atlantic, the European Ocean, had looked like probably several thousand years before the Neolithic Revolution, when people shifted from hunter-gathering to settled communities. So that reframes the story. What I really tried to do is I argued that this first generation of explorers has never really been understood, because the accounts they left have never been presented in light of what was normal for them. What was their baseline when they left Europe? Number one, all the species were the same. Number two, these guys were very, very perceptive. To be a mariner in that age, you had to be perceptive or you died. They paid attention to their surroundings. And number three, following all these very similar species when they got to the Americas, it's like, holy smokes, look at the abundance. So it wasn't a new world. It was just an extension of the old world, the boreal North Atlantic marine ecosystem, that had not yet been harvested.
Well, I think we've typically had this perception that some of those early fishermen and early explorers of this part of the world were kind of blissfully ignorant, thinking that the ocean was enormous and limitless and could be fished at any, you know, at any amount without any impact on the ocean. And you say that, in fact, that wasn't their perception of the situation at all, that especially by the time you get to having actual colonies here in New England, New Plymouth and Mass Bay colonies, some of their earliest laws were actually laws aimed at conserving what they saw as limited or perhaps even endangered marine resources.
Yeah, Heather, that was one of the most striking things to come out of this book. It turns out that from the 1630s until about 1705, here in New England, specifically the Plymouth Colony and then the Massachusetts Bay Colony and then later the Connecticut colonies as well, during those years, basically the 1600s, when the European population here in New England from Kittery, Maine to Norwalk, Connecticut, was pretty thin, tens of thousands at the most as the time went on, the magistrates, the men in charge, the government, passed a series of laws, not just one law, but many laws to conserve fish, laws against using striped bass to manure fields because it was wasteful, laws not to catch cod and haddock and pollock in their spawning seasons, laws to prevent overfishing of mackerel in their spawning seasons, laws to prevent the overfishing of the anadromous fish such as alewives and shad and salmon that came up the rivers to spawn. So what was quite remarkable to me, it was actually stunning, is that here in this marine dreamscape lapping at their feet, this system in which the shoals of silvery mackerel went on forever, in which any boy could pick up as many lobsters as he wanted, in which the right whales came in right to the beach. From the 1630s to 1705, in a variety of laws, the magistrates in these New England colonies tried to conserve those marine resources. That says to me that that first generation coming from Europe was conscious of what had happened in these European ecosystems, and they recognized that depletions could occur, certainly of the river fish, and they took measures to conserve fish for the future.
They were taking measures to try to conserve it, and yet we still saw the extinction of Atlantic salmon, the devastation of many different species during this time, marine mammal populations, fish populations. it really, to me at least, begs the question of whether we are capable of restraining ourselves to a point that we can actually sustainably harvest the ocean.
Yeah, Heather, the historical record of 400 years would provide an emphatic no to your question. In the last 20 years, I think we're moving in the right direction, certainly. New England fishermen, for the most part, still think of 1992 as about the low point. That means that in the last 20 years, things have begun to rebound. Obviously, this year we've had a huge setback with the estimates of cod and the closures that you talked about in the intro to the show. There's also been a big restriction in the Gulf of Maine shrimp season this year. So by no means are we entirely out of the woods. But what the historical record shows, unfortunately, the tragedy at the heart of this book, is that we, just the United States and Eastern Canada, have been having the same discussions for 160 years, discussions about depletion, discussions about diminution, and discussions about what regulation should be in place to slow down that process and to preserve fish for the future. So for 160 years, since basically the time of the Civil War before, these discussions have raged. Now, people have changed sides at different times, and some decades the fishermen have said, we got a real problem, and the scientists said, no, it's fine, nature works in inscrutable ways, just keep fishing. And then more recently, fishermen have said, everything's fine, what do you mean? And scientists said, oh, we got a problem. So the protagonists have occasionally switched camps, and I can go into that if you want, but the real point is that the conversation has been the same since prior to the American Civil War, where certain knowledgeable Americans, at that time it was all fishermen, said, we got a problem, stocks are going down, catches are going down, you, the government, our elected representatives, must do something to take care of this. So this discussion begins in the 1850s, and that, I think, is another sort of stunning revelation of this book. This discussion has not just gone on, let's say, since 1976 with the imposition of the Magnuson-Stevens Act or something else.
Yeah, I mean, you talk a little bit in the book about the founding of the first U.S. Commission on Fish and Fisheries, which was founded in 1871 and you know, has a real connection here to Woods Hole. Spencer Baird started the Fish Commission, was the first fish commissioner, and he really felt that basic research, basic oceanographic research, was fundamentally important to addressing the challenges of trying to manage fisheries. He started what has now become the Northeast Fisheries Science Center here in Woods Hole. But you were talking about this kind of flip-flop in the conversation between scientists and fishermen. And it's interesting that you write that really there was almost from the very beginning of any sort of official government regulation from the founding of this fish commission, there was already a real divide between people like Spencer Baird, who thought that research was essential, and others who thought that some of this research was really a waste of time. And that has really over time developed into a fairly unbridgeable divide between fishermen and fishery scientists.
Yeah, Heather, I wouldn't quite put it like that. I mean, certainly recently there has been what appeared to be an unbridgeable divide since the 70s. But in the 1870s, the century before that, it wasn't like Americans were saying that what the Fish Commission research was doing was a waste. In fact, fishermen were delighted because the U.S. Fish Commission, for the first half of its existence, from about 1870 through the 1930s, was pulling along with fishermen, trying to develop better technology to fish, trying to develop more basic biology to understand the movements and migrations of fish. The Fish Commission and fishermen worked together for 60 or 70 years very closely, and the Fish Commission saw that its raison d'etre was not just to do fundamental research, but was to have an applied economic basis, an economic ichthyology, they called it, to help fishermen fish better. So there was no animosity between scientists and fishermen at the time, other than fishermen were skeptical from the 1850s to the 1930s. Fishermen were very skeptical when Fish Commission naturalists and scientists then said, oh, everything will be all right. The nature works in inscrutable ways. There will be plenty of fish. It's just sort of a short-term blip that has led to these decreases. Fishermen at the time in Maine and Massachusetts and Nova Scotia were not on board with that. But it is important to point out that it was Spencer Baird in the early 1870s, 1873, who talked about the need for the restoration of our exhausted cod fisheries. That was 1870. 1973, not 1973.
I mean, you're very careful in the book to make the point that you don't think that current or past problems with overfishing are something that you can kind of point a finger and lay blame just on fishermen or just on regulations that weren't framed correctly, or you can't lay the blame on any one person or party. That part of the problem really just comes down to an inherent difference between the time scale and the geographic scale of ocean ecosystems and of human communities. And this can really lead to a phenomenon that's come to be called shifting baselines. Can you explain a little bit more about that?
Oh, shifting baselines, in effect, goes like this. It says that each generation comes on the scene, whether that generation, in this case, is a marine scientist or a fisherman. They get raised in their communities, and they become young men or women going out to do their work, typically in their 20s. And they look around, and sort of what they see, they sort of assume is normal. Because, you know, as kids growing up, whatever neighborhood you live in, you assume that's normal. You grow up in a certain political system, you sort of assume that's normal. So people come of age, whether they're, in this case, scientists or fishermen, and they see what they're confronting, and they sort of assume that's normal. And then for them, it's the change over their own lifetime that becomes most important or most significant. And they refer to changes since they were first on the scene, whether doing their field work or fishing or whatever. So what this is, and it's a very human attribute, it's a very normal kind of human way to perceive the world. What it ignores, though, what it suspends attention to, is all the changes that occurred in the system prior to you or me or Mr. or Ms. Scientist Fisherman arriving on the scene. And so the shifting baseline system points out that, for instance, in the 1850s and 1860s, when fishermen in Maine and Massachusetts were desperately convinced that something was wrong as they were catching fewer and fewer true sea fish, not river fish, but true sea fish. And in the 1850s and 60s, they implored their congressmen and their legislators to do something about it. The point is that it's not like they were first on the scene. People have been fishing these waters for 350 years. And, you know, if you look at the statistics of cod landings in my book, it's actually rather stunning. And it goes very quickly like this. 1861, the first year of the Civil War, 70,000 metric tons of cod landed in the Gulf of Maine. A decade later, about 66,000 tons. Two decades after that, about 54,000 tons. This is still all a hook fishery. By the late 1880s, 1890s, it's about 26,000 tons. And that's a gill net and hook fishery. And then by the time we start with draggers, the catches are 10,000 metric tons. That's like around World War I. So you've gone from the Civil War to World War I, and the catches have gone from 70,000 metric tons, small sailboats, small rowboats, hooks, to 10,000 metric tons, steam-powered draggers. Okay, so an old fisherman today might look back to the middle of the 20th century, back to when it was good, except by that time, the system had already been hit really, really, really hard. And so the high concept behind this book is just to reconstruct, really, from the late Middle Ages, when Europeans first arrived here, until the beginning of the dragging revolution around World War I, the changes in the ecosystem, changes in the system, changes in the fisheries prior to industrialization. That's the point, and pretty drastic changes, to tell you the truth.
You say that there have, over hit the course of history, typically been two responses to depleted fish stocks. You were just talking about one, this development of new technology that can allow fishermen to catch more fish, even when there are fewer fish to be had. And then the other is to find new fishing grounds. Neither of those seems like a terribly workable solution for the situation we currently find ourselves in. Is there another option that you can offer based on the research that you've done?
Oh, I'm not a futurist, but you know, for centuries, as fish stocks declined, fishermen had two choices. Like you said, they either developed new gear to fish more intensively where they were, or they took the gear they had and they put it in their boats and they went to some place that had not yet been exploited. Okay, we're basically out of that game. I mean, as the Arctic ice retreats, there will be some Arctic pollock and cod revealed, And as new technologies allow us to fish even deeper and more efficiently, we can probably find the last Patagonian toothfish in the Southern Ocean. So, you know, some new technologies and expansion of fishing area will work. But going forward, the only thing that is going to lead to more fish is an attempt to restore ecosystems. Humans don't have a very good track record of engineering nature to get the outcomes they desire. Humans have a very good track record of following up nature to compromise what they need from the system. And so the challenge going forward is neither to develop new technologies to fish more intensively, we could certainly develop new technologies to fish smarter, but nor is it to go and find unexploited fishing grounds, but it's to try to create, in my estimation, closed areas, marine protected areas, sensible regulations, better gear to try to see some of these fish stocks rebound. But they've been in decline in our waters for 400 years. Not 25 years, not 30 years, not 50 years, 400 years. And so to imagine that anything we do is going to create dramatic improvements in the space of a 2 or 4 year political cycle is a little naive. This has been a problem long in the making. It's going to be a problem that's going to take a long time to resolve. But I'd like to be optimistic and say that going forward, my grandchildren or great-grandchildren could see working waterfronts in New England. You know, I was a commercial mariner for 10 years. I still have my license. I spent a lot of time at sea. Guys that go to sea are my guys, and yet we're in a fix. So going forward, can we have fish and fishermen for the future? That's the challenge.
I want to, we have just a less than a minute left here, but as you've mentioned, you have been a professional mariner and a fisherman. What changed your perspective from someone who enjoyed going out fishing to someone who's really quite cautious about fishing?
Oh, many things over time. You know, I'd have to say one of the most dramatic things is that more than 20 years ago, my father-in-law, who lives in Onset now, used to live in Wareham, Dick Wheeler, he's sort of known as the Auk guy. He paddled his kayak on a solo voyage from Newfoundland to Cape Cod to retrace the migratory path of the great auk, the now extinct North American penguin. And along the way, he talked with fishermen at every step of the way. And they began to see these analogies between the extinction of the auk and what was going on with the extinction of the fisheries. And it happened to be that year that the Canadians closed the Grand Banks. So it was Dick's trip, and it was the closure of the storied Grand Banks cod fishery. Those things got me thinking about this, and when it came time to write another book, that's what I plunged into.
Dr. Jeffrey Bolster is Associate Professor of History and Co-Director of the Center for History of Marine Animal Populations at University of New Hampshire. We've been talking about his latest book, The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. Jeff, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Heather. Bye-bye.
Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.